Good morning. You're listening to Health Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and today's guest is Dr. Peter Diadamo. Dr. Diadamo is a naturopathic physician, a researcher, and the author of the best-selling Eat Right for Your Type, which was translated into over 50 languages with more than 5 million copies now in print worldwide. Dr. Peter Diadamo is here on Health Watch today to talk about his new book, Change Your Genetic Destiny, the first and most complete tool for tailoring a diet, lifestyle, and health plan to match your unique genetic profile. Welcome back to Health Watch, Dr. Diadamo.
Hi, David. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today?
I'm trying to stay warm.
It's cold in Connecticut?
Very cold.
So Dr. Diadamo, the title of your book suggests that our genes are not our destiny, and I know the common thought is what's in our genes is not something that can be changed, but your book is suggesting something else. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. If anybody's picked up this week's Time magazine, they would see that the cover article is actually on something called epigenetics, which is the revolution that's occurring in genetics right now as we speak, that is essentially turning the genetics that you and I learned in high school and in college upside down, or the notion of how genes are agents of change actually upside down. We were taught that change occurs through a long process of natural selection and mutations and that kind of thing, which certainly is true, but it really is not the framework by which we as entities adapt to the environment on a more ongoing day-to-day basis. We have roughly 70% of our genes are very malleable by the environment to the sense that the genes themselves are not changed per se. I mean, you can't change the gene to get blue eyes if you've got brown eyes. But 70% of your genes are known as what are called luxury genes, in that they are amenable to essentially having their degree of expression controlled. So the listeners might benefit by analogy that one researcher used, where he likened these luxury genes as having essentially little volume controls on them that could turn the desire for the need of what the gene produced up or down depending upon environmental circumstances. Now, in and of itself, that would be revolutionary, that the idea that we are that resourceful when it comes to rearranging our genes in response to the environment. But the bigger and more profound element is that these volume control settings are as inheritable as the gene themselves, which means basically that when you go on and foster the next generation, they start out with the volume control settings in a way sort of essentially the same way that you had them when you turned over them to the offspring. So it does a lot to explain why many tendencies are found in families and such are known to be genetic, but are at this point still lacking a clear-cut genetic association. It may simply be that these people are not possessing or not possessing a gene difference. They may simply have their volume controls adjusted in a way that promotes autism in one family and cancer in another.
So are you saying that if we inherit a certain set of genes, we also are inheriting the way that our parents how their behavior, their lifestyle and diet turned up or down the volume of certain genes versus another?
Yes. In essence, a good example, for instance, is how if we look at variation, let's say in the animal kingdom, and animals have, in general, short lifespans. And, I mean, look at the different breeds of dogs, right? All the variations that are found in the canine species. But we also know that, for instance, lab animals are routinely bred to develop certain types of characteristics that could be used in research. So you have strains of mice that are bred to be obese or to develop cancer, or in the case of one strain of mice, to be obese and then develop cancer. And it turns out that those tendencies can be engendered through certain environmental influences, and that becomes inheritable in that strain of mice. And yet, so much of it is changeable through modification of the developmental environment, that actually by doing some very simple things with those mice at the point where they are pregnant with subsequent generations, things that are commonplace in a naturopath's toolbox, folic acid and methyl donors and choline, things that basically wouldn't normally be thought to have such provocative effects, at the end of one generation, you can reverse many of those tendencies that were bred in those animals, the obesity and diabetes and things. So what we're starting to see is actually the three or four generations up into the immediate distant future and the prenatal environment all come together to create a biological trajectory that a person possesses through the course of their life. And many of the illnesses that they'll get later in life will be the result of the imprinting that occurred at that earlier time period.
But that idea seems to be liberating in the sense that it seems like you could change your family's destiny into the future by behavior modification now.
I actually did some calculations about 2 years ago. And well, to understand the profound nature of this, again, let's look at what's wrong with genetics, and then we'll discuss what's right about genetics and what's right about epigenetics. Here we have done this very elaborate human genome project, and we discover, lo and behold, that we have 27,000 genes. And we also discover, unfortunately, that earthworms have 44,000 genes.
That's interesting.
And certain types of wheat plants have 600,000 genes. So you and I are not at the top of the evolutionary heap, largely because we're more complicated. It's apparent that we are able to do more in the developmental realm. That's what characterizes our difference from other lower species. It's that we're not more complicated than they are. We just do a better job of developing based out of the patterning that occurs in the early part of our lives. So if you look at it like that, you can see that this explains why we've got 14 or 15 genes associated with autism, we've got 45 genes associated with diabetes, but none of them have a real strong association. And yet we know that those things run in families, and we know that the families are probably not possessing any real clear-cut genetic distinction. They're more imprinted epigenetically to get that particular type of thing. So you're essentially getting diseases not because you've got new disease genes, but rather you're 70% of the genes in your body are just twisted in that direction, and that's what you're conveying through the lines. Now, if you could make a difference, you could pass that improvement on. And really what I was saying at the very beginning was that actually some calculations I did a couple of years ago concluded that you could route certain things out of a family lineage in three or four generations. And so is really the goal going forward, is it going to be a war on cancer, or should we just be looking at trying to engineer it out of people and just kind of look at it as a sort of one-on-one form of therapy rather than some massive public health initiative?
You're listening to Health Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host, and today we're talking with Dr. Peter Diadamo, the author of Change Your Genetic Destiny. Dr. Diadamo, so your book doesn't just suggest that we have this capacity to change the way our genes express, but you actually also go farther and suggest that different people are going to have a different solution based on what you call a genotype. And I'm hoping that you can explain to our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, a while back in the 1950s, a guy named Waddington came up with what was thought to be this developmental pathway that basically people start out, you know, we all start out as a kind of an egg yolk kind of thing, and then we turn into these complicated people that we become later on in life. And really it's a whole series of journeys that we take as we develop morphologically, we develop our shape and function. And each of those represent a series of trade-offs. I guess if you look at it from a metaphorical standpoint, you could see that, you know, classic genetics is a lot like looking at a blueprint for a building. You can easily grasp what the building is. You can easily grasp the general shape, the general purpose of the building. But you'd be surprised how many times you show up at the building and it doesn't quite look like the blueprint because somebody made a series of trade-offs. They might have discovered that there wasn't enough money for slate roof, so they got a vinyl roof, or there wasn't enough money for copper gutters, so they got aluminum gutters. So you can only go so far looking at the blueprint, and then really you start to realize that you might as well look at the house, because ultimately that's going to not only give you the ability to reverse engineer the blueprint, but you're going to see all the amendments that were made as well. And so when I look at what's called an epigenotype, or what I call a genotype or epigenotype, is that actually you're looking at being able to take measurements on that person that you can compare to known occurrences or associations or rates of happening that are associated with genes. So genes themselves tend to come related one to the other. And so if you look at it, if you do enough analysis, you can kind of pretty much narrow down the general tendencies that people are going to adopt as they develop into essentially three basic worldviews. And it doesn't really get much simpler than this. It's the reactive worldview, which is prone to inflammation, kind of a I reject the world kind of thing. There's the receptor worldview, which is a more immunologically tolerant view, which is I'm a little bit more inclined to want to get along, so I might be prone maybe to overgrowth or malignancies. And then there's the I don't understand the world worldview, which is what you might say, I came programmed for one thing, but that's not exactly what I discovered is out there. And that's what you see with people with metabolic problems. They might have been imprinted early on in life, perhaps maybe for scarcity, so they become what's known as thrifty. They hold on to calories like a person maybe holds on to money.
And are these survival strategies imprinted through what's happening to the mother while the embryo is forming in the womb?
And also the direct inheritance of the prior 3 to 4 generations as well. Yeah, so for instance, I mean, at the risk of not totally alienating your audience, but I mean, you know, we have certain proclivities immunologically that have to do with how we are, how our helper cells are programmed in certain characteristics. Some people have what's called a TH1, other people have a TH2 dominance, and a lot of that's related to environmental influences. So the idea that if you have a proclivity for more autoimmune diseases, you probably would have been biased for more of a reactive type of view of things. So looking at how I got into epigenetics through blood group is actually kind of interesting as well, because I really looked at blood groups as essentially as anyone would look at a pretty classic gene. You know, here's a gene that controls physiology or digestion or some relationship. So really the first 10 years of my life, I would learn all there was to learn about certain blood groups, and then I would adjust my recommendations based upon what the findings were telling me. So it was adjusting people to their genes, basically. In the later part of my career, I decided that actually I wanted to adjust genes to the people. And so I got more into this notion of epigenetics, but I got there by blood type. I was reading an article on ear infections, and they showed that if you had a mother who was type A blood, you were 29 times more likely to get a second ear infection in the first year of your life. So here was a relationship between kids getting ear infections that had nothing to do with their blood type. It had to do with the blood type of their mother. And then I started reading about what maybe is the ultimate reason we have a blood type in the first place, which is to control how our body restructures itself as we grow, and we develop what are known as germ layers, the parts of us that become the different organ systems. It seems that blood group plays a big role in that. And so I started looking at developmental aspects that could be predicted by virtue of blood groups, but in light of those three basic views. I reject the environment, I accept the environment, or I'm totally confused by the environment. And when I superimpose those components over the known characteristics of blood groups, I could see that there was an epigenetic component there that I could actually identify. So after that, it just became really a characterization exercise.
So for presumably each of these different genotypes that people fall into would have a different risk for certain conditions, but also a different solution in terms of how to eat and how to exercise. How do you tell people, or how do you determine for your patients which genotype each one falls into?
Well, most of it is based on measurements that it can be conducted in my office in one sitting. So there's no real classic or involved genetic testing. We do simple things. I mean, we develop a profile that is based on blood type. It's based upon what are called dermatoglyphics, which is a fancy word for fingerprint analysis. And we also will do a variety of certain type of biometric measurements, comparing lengths of certain bones to other bones. Actually, anybody can do this. It's pretty simple. And you take the outcome of these things, And you sort of essentially calculate this in terms of, well, what's known in epigenetics is canalization. It's a fancy word, but really all it means is that if I had a marble at the top of a hill, and the hill had six valleys, at a certain point the marble is going to wind up in one of those six valleys. And so to a certain degree, you could have said, well, maybe under a different circumstance it might have rolled in one of the other valleys, but it rolled in this one. So what you're really doing is trying to find which of the one of the six versions is going to have the best job of encapsulating the most variation in that person. Now, the problem with books is that they're not terribly flexible, which is that if you do the best you can, you're going to roll the person into one of those six basic genotypes. They're certainly going to have other aspects of them that might be found in the other genotypes, but the one that they wind up with will have the best job of getting the most of their variation. It will be the closest approximation of the one that they could most happily reside in.
Could you pick one of those measurements, fingerprints or leg length compared to torso, or another one, and just explain how that would relate to a genotype and a different way of eating and exercising?
Sure.
That'd be great.
Let's take a fingerprint. Fingerprints are not as complicated as people think. You only have, like, basically three patterns. So it's like chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry. You have what are called arches, where the ridges look like a little hill. You have whorls, where the ridges sort of look like a kind of a swirl. And you have loops, where the ridges kind of look like a lasso. Well, it turns out that if women have five or more of the whorl-type pattern, it's associated with an extraordinarily high rate of breast cancer. Matter of fact, in two studies, it's associated with a relative rate of significance on par with a positive mammogram. So here you have a fingerprint pattern, which is associated with a higher rate of breast cancer, and is characteristic of the genotype known as the teacher, which is common in blood type A, which is a blood type in and of itself, which has a very slightly higher rate of breast cancer, but in our own research, we've shown that the rate of outcome in breast cancer is not as desirable as in the other blood types. So in other words, they don't get it any more frequently, but they don't survive it as good as the others. So now you've taken a fingerprint element and a blood group element and put them together in such a way so that the two occurrences amplify the significance of the other. In genetics, it's called pleiotropy, where basically if you're trying to link the occurrence of certain phenomena with other dependencies. Now, if you look at what might be a good thing for the teacher to emphasize in their diet, it turns out that these are one of the few people in the world that probably should eat soy, because not only will it have a positive effect in terms of adjusting some of the genetics with regard to gene health, activation, and silencing, because soy is a wonderful methylator of genetic material. Methylation is really the equivalent of taking a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, and then instead of making the sixth photocopy of a photocopy, you actually put in a new original. So in essence, when you actually methylate genes, you increase their fidelity. And so one of the nice things about soy in this particular type is it has a wonderful effect on gene fidelity, but there's also proteins in soy that take advantage of a propensity of certain types of cancers to want to mimic the blood type in these people. Very common cancers often do that. For instance, breast cancer is very A-like. It looks immunologically like the chemical that's known to be associated with blood type A. So if you can imagine now, you can consume a substance that has a protein in it that actually can target the slight difference between the person's blood type and the cancer that's trying to look like the person's blood type. You've got a real nice mechanistic relationship for that recommendation.
So would you be suggesting that if people follow the measurements in the book, Change Your Genetic Destiny, and discover that they're the genotype teacher and may have a higher risk of breast cancer, that by following the dietary recommendations, you would then have the potential to lower the volume on those genes that increase your risk?
Yes. And one of the classic things, as we said before, one of the worldviews is this overly tolerant worldview, mm-hmm. which is known as a receptor type. Well, the teacher is a classic receptor genotype. Part of the other things that you find with teachers is they tend to have large amounts of bacterial overgrowth in their body. So, for instance, one of the things we have a great correlation with this genotype and blood type with what is called a breath hydrogen reading. So when you measure the amount of hydrogen in a person's breath, it usually is indicative of a large amount of bacterial activity in their digestive tract. And so, again, you can see how just simply the idea that being tolerant, you know, gives you some advantages. I mean, it might make it a little easier if you'd expand your diet. It might make you a little less prone to autoimmune disease or allergies. But the other side of the coin is it might make you a little bit more susceptible to maybe not doing the surveillance that you need to do in order to lower your body's risk of cancer, or might not necessarily make you very effective in terms of lowering your risk of certain types of infections. So the idea of eating proactively is to come up with a diet that addresses, to the best of our understanding of what diets can do, those susceptibilities. Another genotype, the gatherer, is a classic example of somebody with a metabolic tendency towards obesity or syndrome X, metabolic syndrome. And once you run some characterizations on them, the gatherer diet is largely a what's called a low glycation diet. It inhibits the amount of sort of bizarre changes that you make to sugar molecules when your metabolism isn't adjusted properly. And these are people who tend to have terrible effects dieting. They don't diet well because they're epigenetically, they're imprinted for scarcity. See, when they were in the womb, something was happening to their prenatal environment that was roughing them up, and they interpreted that as a reflection on the outside world that required them to repattern themselves to hold on to calories. It might be that they interpreted something in the mom's lifestyle as being deprivation, and maybe famine. So they reprogram themselves, re-imprint themselves to become thrifty. And just like the thrifty person who holds on to money, they hold on to calories.
So if people who are interested in following or trying the genotype diet, is it a radical transformation of how they eat typically? And how do you help guide people towards going from where they're at to that change?
You know, David, I would say that most people who were new to the whole thing should probably pick up a copy of the Eat Right for Your Type and just get to know their blood type, because you can do some amazing things with just simply knowing your blood type. Because really, think about it, you know, being a naturopath, you tend to sort of we come in two varieties, ones who are driven by our belief systems and others who have no belief system whatsoever. I tend to fall more in the latter category, to the degree that I think that all diets are fundamentally probably okay, and some are better for some people than others. So you go into the diet bookshelves, and there's, you know, low protein, high protein, low carb, high carb, low fat, high fat, paleolithic, vegan, you know. So the end result is you sort of, at least with the blood type diet, you're actually going to just get some insight as to what fundamental type diet will be best for you. Then the next step would be, all right, let's see how far you want to take this. Do you want to go to that next level, in which case you can go into the genotype system and actually start to adjust and kind of refine it further with these simple measurements and things. And a lot of this can be, like I say, if you can, well, I used to say this, if you could put a piece of furniture together from IKEA, you could probably figure out your genotype. But then some people told me that they couldn't actually make furniture from IKEA. So I'm not going to say that per se, but if you can do anything that requires just working from some kind of a set of instructions, because it's not very hard to measure your finger, you know, compared to another finger.
And with the research you've been doing, Dr. D'Adamo, on this, how well is that, or poorly, has that been received in the scientific community at large? Are you finding that you're finding other people taking up this research and pursuing it as well, or are you finding a lot of opposition?
Good question. I find that the notion of individualizing diet is something everybody is willing to testify to. The notion that maybe a naturopath figured it out maybe better than a lot of the other sources of authority, a lot of people have trouble with still. I'm not sure necessarily if I would say that the science is as questionable as the fact that we still have a ongoing dialogue as to the role of naturopaths in terms of being able to provide this level of insight. For instance, I think that if you look at the blood type system, which actually was pioneered by my father, he used to say that he thought that it would be impossible for anybody but a naturopath to have ever been interested enough in this area to have ever made the discovery. And it's probably true. I don't think there's anybody in conventional medicine that paid any attention whatsoever to blood type other than the fact that it screws up transfusions. So if you look at it from the perspective of reception in terms of the accolades that normally would come if one basically produced a discovery of this nature, I would say they're there, but the idea is still sort of in its own wilderness period. I mean, ultimately, when you write a book 2 years ago that somehow or another gets profiled in Time magazine, you know, last week, you know that you're probably going to have the problems that come from simply just being a little too ahead of people. And so I think that actually what I would say is that people are catching up to blood type now, like in terms of 14 years after I wrote that book. I suspect it'll be a while before they actually understand that what this can do for them. But the average consumer doesn't have the slightest problem with it. I mean, they're just able to really just take it and go with it. And it has all the advantages of what a consumer would want. It's low technology. It's inexpensive. It uses food as medicine. It uses, as I tell my own patients, you're going to take your private time and convert it into my therapy time. So ultimately, the thing that you can do for yourself every day of the week is the thing that I can't do for you when you come and see me every 2 months or 3 months or once a year.
Dr. D'Adamo, we're almost out of time, unfortunately. I was hoping you could, if you have a website or other place to send people for resources, that you could mention that.
Sure. The main one is the what's called the D'Adamo.com website. It's actually my last name, so it's D-A-D-A-M-O.com. And it's not a stutter. It's actually my last name, D-A-D-A-M-O.com. And that's really the one with all the forums and the blogs and all the bulletin boards. And really, I encourage people to go there and just snoop around. It's really an information-rich site. And you can take this to any degree or any level that you want. And I think the nice thing about the system is that it can reward a person who just wants to know what to do, and it can reward a person who wants to know why they're doing it as well.
Well, it was great having you back on Health Watch today.
Nice talking with you again, David.
You've been listening to Health Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Dr. David Naiman, and our guest today was Dr. Peter D'Adamo. If you missed any part of today's show, you can go to the Health Watch page on the website at kboo.fm/healthwatch. The audio should be on the website by tomorrow. Stay tuned for It Takes a Village.